This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the February 3rd, 2017 edition of the DRF Players Podcast, show 209. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you, no longer in a freezing automobile next to a Labrador, instead next to a Labrador in the Brooklyn bunker, back where I belong. And the great news about today, we are back with the usual crew. We have from the Queens bunker, not the DRF offices in New York, but the Queens bunker, Mike Hogan. How are you today, Mike?
I was dealing with a little migraine earlier, but I'm doing better now. So
I hope that migraine's better. That's nothing to be doing a podcast with.
Hey, you know, I don't get the super, super headache. I just get the aura where I can't see. It's all sparkly and, you know. And then I feel a little dazed afterwards. So it's not as bad as some migraines that people get.
I've got friends who pay a lot of money to feel that way.
Fair enough.
Also, back on the show, after being detained at the airport for undisclosed reasons, calling in from Planet Texas, got to get that plane fixed, JK, Jonathan Kinchin.
What's up, guys? What's up? What's up? Yeah, it's day three back from Vegas, and most people who know who go to Vegas, like, it takes a long time to get your body back in order.
There was definitely a jet lag factor for me. I would say, yeah, yesterday was the first day I started feeling half normal, and even this morning just a little built up. It's tough because you go out there, you know, especially I'll have morning deadlines, so I'm working on Eastern time in Las Vegas, but typically socializing on Western time. So you end up getting a few hours of sleep shaved off the schedule. Why don't we start, Jonathan, by talking about your trip to Vegas? We didn't really talk about you specifically, though we did deconstruct the tournament as a whole on the last show, if folks want to take a listen back to show 208. But looked like you were in a pretty good spot at the end of day one. Give us an overview of your Vegas experience this year.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, this tournament, there's always a lot of reflection when it's over. I think for most players, you always kind of, even if you got the guys who got second, are probably wondering what could I have done differently and what could have changed the outcome. You know, it's hard. There is a lot of races. There's a lot of options, a lot of opportunities. Every single person, it's one of the most annoying things in the world, to be honest. Every single person has their bad beat story about this, that, and this, that, and that, and that. Would have happened that I would have been in the top 66 or I would have made the final table. It's hard. Things have to kind of go your way. And when I look back at what I would have done differently, there's not – the bottom line is I would have gotten a little bit luckier. You know, I mean –
It's a great answer.
I was in a great position because of luck, right? A good friend of mine, Nick Tamro, used the six horse at Fairgrounds in a three-year-old race. And he got taken down, and I went up. And that me going up made the difference. Yes, there's horses here and there that I was going to pick that didn't pick. Yes, I ran third at big prices a couple times. Yes, I fell asleep and didn't pay attention and missed. I mean, there's all those opportunities, right? So it's just like it can be a frustrating result. But at the end of the day, I was in position, and that's what I can always – as long as I'm in position I'm okay with that. And so, you know, you can probably tell by my voice, it's a frustrating situation. But it is what it is. And there'll always be next year and there'll be another tournament, next week.
You were able to watch that final table more as an observer. Any particular notes or impressions, JK, you have of what went down as, we got to the end of the sharp end of the NHC on Sunday night?
No, not at all. Not at all. I thought when we had talked about it, when we periscoped, even before Ray hit that 13-1 shot or whatever, the three horse at Fairgrounds, I thought it was over. And when that happened, I thought it was a foregone conclusion. I thought all of the excitement of who was going to win the tournament was over at that point. So I thought Ray always had it well in hand the interesting part came is what people were going to do behind them. Were you going to shoot away for second and first place, trying to catch them, or were you going to just try to improve your position? Ironically enough, I didn't hear it firsthand, but I heard a story of someone who was upset at a short price horse that was played late to advance someone a position I find that to be a little bit silly.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. You might be talking about the guy who I actually have a profile of going up on DRF.com any minute, friend of the podcast, Dan Kovaleski, who played a shorty late. From his point of view, from Dan's point of view, he handicapped those final table races. He thought there were excellent opportunities to reach for prices early on. He got to the final table, I think, in second, and had the idea that he was going to take a shot, see if it was his lucky day, see if he was going to have a chance to walk out of there with the $800,000. Did not do well in those first few races at the final table. Halfway through, looked up after that Fairgrounds race, and I want to come back to that Fairgrounds race when we're done talking about this to ask you one other question about it. But at some point, looked up, liked Logical Horses in the last few races, and realized that every point he got could potentially push him $25,000 richer because of the way that pay structure works. To me, absolute smartest thing in the world. To me, I have been known in a previous lifetime playing in a lot more tournaments myself to play. I once played an odds-on horse to sneak a couple extra grand in the last race where I knew everybody else was going to be shooting for the win. To me, that's just part of the game. That's just smart playing. If the player who got passed in that scenario, I mean, does he have anything to complain about at all?
No, not even a little bit. And, look, one of my strongest opinions of the day was the 10 was going to win that last race. Like, and it's, you know, he was 2-1. So, you know, do what you will with that. But one of the strongest opinions I had the entire day was that he was going to win that race. And for Dan to have an opportunity to win another, whatever it was, $15,000, $25,000 to take a 2-1 shot, I feel like he has no apologies to anyone. And in fact, the guy who is playing a 15-1 shot that had no chance, he should be apologizing to his family.
When you think of the math, it's pretty amazing. It's as if in that situation, you have two chances, right? You can either try to, hit a half-court shot. You can hit a half-court shot for some incredible sum of money, or you can have a layup and have an $8,000 free roll. Which would you prefer, JK?
Yeah, no, I want the layup. I mean, look, I'm not gonna knock anyone for trying to turn a 15-1 shot into a 75-1 shot is essentially what it. Well, even probably more than that, a 300-1 shot. You know, if you can win an extra couple thousand here or there, I mean, 25,000, 40,000, 50,000, 100,000, do your thing. But for me, it's take what the defense gives you, and if you know, and I'm never going to knock anyone for doing so.
Like we always say, it comes down. In truth, that situation comes down to your opinion on the race. It doesn't have to do with the odds of the horse. It has to do with what you think is going to happen on the racetrack and which horse you like. Sometimes that half-court shot might have so much upside that it is worth taking, but definitely nothing untoward about the way Danny Kaye played it, and I think might have to, for the person who was upset, might have to break out the world's smallest violin.
Right, yeah. I mean, the thing about it is like, if Dan liked the 25-1 shot, he would have took it.
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, he showed that in the horses he played up to that point. Now, we talked before about that key race at the final table, that Fairgrounds race that the three-horse won. Pretend, put yourself in Steve Wolfson Jr.'s shoes. He, at that point, had a very realistic shot of getting to Ray. He liked the same horse. He gets up on the table, gets up at the final table, and he and Ray know each other from way back. It's not like there was any trash-talking element to this. And Ray asks Steve Jr., what did you play? Steve Jr. says, I like the three. Arsenault says, I hope he wins, indicating right away to Steve that he's been blocked. How does he feel in that moment? Have you ever been there?
Oh, I've been blocked before. It's the worst feeling in the world. Yeah, I've been blocked. I can't remember a big tournament had happened to me where I want to say it was that Keeneland thing that you wrote about where I messed up with the mastery thing. And part of the reason that I didn't get there was I was blocked. Like someone in front of me used the horse that I used in the last. So we both moved up. It's the worst feeling because, you know, this game is about opinions and about placing a wager on your opinion. And when they break from the gate and you know that no matter what happens, it's not going to do you any good. It's a very hopeless feeling.
Now, in this case, at least, Steve Jr. had the idea of a second spot worth $250,000 that he knew if this horse did win, yeah, maybe the 800's out of reach, but it made the 250 very, very close, and it really changed the dynamic. I feel like after that race, it was really players in third through 10th all playing and slash protecting for third, Ray way out in front, and Steve Jr. in this sort of beautiful position where he had two things he could do. He could chase Ray or he could try to protect. And because of the way the leaderboard fell, it was the same horse that would do both things. You know what I'm saying? He would be, by playing prices, he's protecting somebody coming up to get him. He had that much of a lead. And it's also, hey, if one of them happened to win, he might have been breathing heavier on Ray's neck at the end. So it was a really interesting little laboratory for strategy at the final table, I thought.
No, absolutely.
We had a few questions come in. Now, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I'm just going to be an adult and blame Vegas Brain that there were two or three people, maybe three or four people, who sent in questions and comments that I didn't even think about all that much. I just responded to them based on the quality of the question. This would be a great thing to talk about in the pod. Well, with 5 minutes to post today, I went back to sort of look for those things and couldn't find any of them because I'm so fried. So those people I said that would be great to talk about in the pod, please email me your question again at podcast@drf.com. Hit me up on Twitter. This time I promise I will write it down and we'll talk about those later on. We did have a couple of questions I do remember that we might as well get to now. One of them involved the NHC final table format. Friend of the podcast, Jim Timmink, suggested, and he got pretty specific into the suggestions of how it could be done. But the idea of taking that final table and adding drama by adding some sort of live bankroll element to it, allowing for more movement on the leaderboard, I thought it was an intriguing idea. I was just curious to get your thoughts, Jonathan, on if that's something that you would approve of.
Yeah, I mean, we've joked before that I think it'd be cool if, like, whatever you came to the final table with became a live bankroll. And so you got, you know, Ray came to the table with 300 and Steve Wilson with 260 or whatever it is. But the only, and, you know, that would be cool, right? Because then it can move around. The only problem that I have with it is that you can't do so well for 2 days in this tournament and then kind of lose your entire edge. You'd have no edge in that situation from three, you know, if you had $320 to having
$200. You don't think having an extra $20 is an advantage?
No, not enough. Not in a live bankroll format with 10 races. No, I don't think so.
So let me ask this. I'm going to jump in real quick. Please. If there was a live bankroll format in the final table, would there be any sort of cap like there was 2.5 days of the rest of the tournament?
Well, I believe that Jim's idea addresses this by having, let me see, if I'm just going to look through his email and see if I can if I can say what he said, because when I read it, it made sense to me. You have to bet all the seven races. You must wager an even amount of money win in place, and you must wager a minimum of, so you're basically wagering a minimum of two win place and up to your whole bankroll. In other words, if you have 120, you could do 60 win place. I thought it was a little bit interesting. And I think, you know, since we're just talking theoretically, I think you might be right, Mike, since if you're keeping that sort of basic model of the win place contest, I think it would be appropriate to have a cap there.
And yeah. I think you'd have to, right?
How much of a, well, I mean, there are tournaments like the Surfside tournament where it's $2 win place, but there's no cap. And those tournaments are occasionally won by one horse. So,
right, but they don't switch mid tournament.
No,
you know,
no,
I think
no,
that's
no, no.
That's sort of the issue is if everybody's playing under these certain guidelines and then it changes, you know, I would think you'd want to keep the cap.
Would that be enough of an edge, JK, for the leader? Do you think, or is it still not enough of a reward for being on top of the mountain for 2.5 days?
Yeah, I just don't feel like there's enough of it's enough of a reward. You know, I just think that if you put yourself in that position like Ray did and I believe like Paul did as well last year. There has to be some weight for that.
It's
interesting
that you say that as a guy who likes live bankroll, because of course live bankroll is the exact opposite. There's essentially a disadvantage to being in first going into the last race because you're the target score that everybody's shooting for. How do you reconcile those two opinions?
Oh, I disagree with that. I'd love to be in first going into the last of a live bankroll tournament. They have to hit, and I can hit too. But I bet in the last race. You know what I mean? So I'm going to move the target, and I'm going to say that my handicapping is good enough that I can hit the last race while everyone else is trying to hit it too.
It's interesting. No, that's a different way of looking at it than I was, but it's certainly a valid point of view.
I'd rather be in front and have to come get me. It's kind of the same way I bet races, right? I would rather be in a turf sprint. I'd rather be on the front at the 16th pole and be tired than have something, than be trying to weave through traffic after coming six wide. You know what I mean?
I'm not saying I wouldn't rather be in front. I'm just saying that as we've seen so many years, especially in the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, you don't really get, to me, you just don't get, you get much more of an advantage being in first place going to the final table, say, way more of an advantage than you do being in front in a live bankroll contest with a few races to go. I just feel like you could be the longtime winner in live bank and you're going to get pipped a lot more easily.
No, I agree. I think the problem in those situations is a lot of people grab in the last race because they have the lead and they play conservatively and hope that no one catches. I, on the other hand, would bet in the last race. If I'm at Santa Anita and I've got $16,000 and the next person below me has, $11,000, I'm going to bet $2,500 in the last race.
I would argue you might want to bet $4,999 if you have a strong opinion, right?
Right, but I don't think you don't want to come back too much to the field and then let someone catch a $1,000 show horse and they beat you. But
yeah, that's fair.
I would try to extend. I wouldn't just sit and wait and be a sitting target.
It's interesting. I think we're going to end up having a lot more live bankroll discussion this year. Muggs, the handicapping Labrador, certainly in favor of that. So we'll keep that going. But we did a lot of tournament talk, which makes sense. It's your first show, JK, after the NHC. Of course, you also missed out on our deconstruction of the Pegasus. I think we should revisit that for at least a couple of minutes here. I got myself, I feel like I'm a bigger American Pharoah fan than a lot of my closest horse playing friends. I feel like I respected his accomplishments like a lot and from the get-go, and have made the case myself as to why some of his speed figures were lower than they ended up being printed in the pages of the racing form due to, not that they were incorrect figures, but just due to various circumstances. And I seem to upset, though, the legion of AP fans when I suggested that in terms of brilliance, Arrogate was the more special horse to me. Where do you stand on that issue, Jonathan?
It's funny. I listened to Vic the other day. I listened to Baffert back, and Baffert said that American Pharoah would have won every race that Arrogate won this year.
Interesting.
So I thought that was an interesting fact, and I tried to like kind of re-handicap and play those races out in my head. I think what you said is I had no problem with it. I actually listened on the plane. To me, it's not apples and oranges, but it's different, right? American Pharoah did something that no other horse has done in a long time, and it's something that inside of its own self is very challenging. With the challenges with travel and the time in between races and stuff like that, winning the Triple Crown and then staying on well enough, long enough to win the Breeders' Cup Classic. With that said, when it comes to these people that say that figures don't matter, it's kind of annoying because they do matter. But I think that Arrogate's brilliance this year has been special. I am not interested in saying who I would pick over one another. I think it's kind of it's too hard to compare the two. But at the same time, I have no problem with what you said. I think Arrogate is brilliant. I think what Pharoah did was brilliant. I don't see an advantage of comparing the two because they didn't really do the same thing. It was two different scenarios. Because here's the truth. If Arrogate was healthy, he probably would have won the Triple Crown.
Well, that's interesting. Now, that's a very interesting idea. And I was thinking that he needed the time to grow up, and that even if he'd been healthy, I don't think he could have accomplished what American Pharoah did, simply because, just like looking at the percentages and how many horses have tried and how many horses get themselves jammed up and can't complete those kind of peak efforts at that time in their season. Mike Hogan, what do you think on all sides of this issue?
Well, you know, I listened to Baffert on BIC as well, and he didn't really give an answer. He did say, yeah, American Pharoah would have won all the races that Arrogate won, but he didn't say one was better than the other. He kind of demurred a bit and didn't want to go down that path, and sort of said they were different and brilliant and or better brilliant in different ways. But I'm kind of with you, Pete. I don't think Arrogate would have won the Triple Crown for a few reasons. This is a horse who seems to benefit from some time between races. And I don't know if we would have seen the kinds of huge performances we saw in the Travers, and then, what, 7 or 8 weeks off to the Breeders' Cup, and then I don't know how many, 9 or 10, 12 weeks off to the Pegasus. This is a horse who I think that the grueling Triple Crown grind might have taken its toll. This is it's an unbridled song colt. They have notoriously have issues. He obviously had some issues. It took a little while for him to get to the races. I don't know if he could have done what American Pharoah did, and I don't know if his accomplishments after American Pharoah diminish what American Pharoah did. I mean, I think they're both fantastic horses.
At all. I was never meaning to say that for a minute. It was just a throwaway comment I made on a podcast that turned into a conversation on Twitter. But, I mean, you make a great point about the unbridled song thing. And I'll say this, sort of maybe arguing against my original it's a tangential point. It's not really arguing against myself, but I think you could maybe come up with the idea that maybe Pharoah, along the lines of what Baffert said, Pharoah maybe could have done what Arrogate did with more time, with, you know, the excuse to run again in January, et cetera, et cetera. You could see his corresponding figures elevating maybe with a little more time between races. And I do think maybe it is doubtful that Arrogate could have done what the Pharoah did because of the breeding and the various other aspects you're pointing out. Can you live with any of that, JK, or are we making your blood boil over there?
No, it's fine, but I just think that it's kind of interesting discussion if you were to flip the scenarios. I mean, imagine if Pharoah didn't run at 2, didn't have the issue that had him miss the juvenile, then he had all that time to kind of just fill out and develop and be a horse, and then he shows up in an allowance race in the summer, and then he runs in the Travers fresh. I mean, I think he does the same thing.
That's interesting.
Yes. Yep. I don't think that Arrogate's situation was a maturity problem. I think it was more of a unbridled song soundness issue that kept him from running. Baffert doesn't have horses that like aren't mature enough to start on the campaign. They usually just kind of can't handle the workload and get hurt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair. That's a fair
point. Well, but he also hasn't been getting as many from Judmont, and I think what the Judmont crew does is a little different from some of his other owners and their approach and their goals, too.
Oh, no doubt. We talked about that on the show. Way different goals as a, you know, one of the world's leading breeding operations than your sort of average USA horse owner who I think it's fair to say many of whom have the attitude to the detriment of the game that it's derby or bust. And with that thought in mind, you know, let's hope that more horsemen feel that they have permission to bring horses along the way that Arrogate was brought along. And who knows, maybe the Pegasus becomes an excuse also to have a later year target, so we don't see quite as many horses, you know, going through the being forced a little bit at least, and sometimes a lot bit, to compete in the Triple Crown to the detriment of their later careers. Hopefully this is going to you know, represent, if not a sea change, at least a positive element and a slightly another option, let's say, for folks to train horses going forward. I think that would be a super positive development for horse players and equines alike. All right, we got some races to talk about. We had we got a few things to do here. Let's, because we have these Triple Crown preps this weekend. Before we get into the sort of Triple Crown preps in earnest, Mike, there was a very specific question about the Swale Stakes, I believe. What do you have that up in front of you?
There was. Brad Heil wanted to know specifically about the Mark Cassie horse, Vanish, who he says looks intriguing at a price. Looked in good form before stretching out in his last race. Should get plenty to stock. He's 12-1 on the morning line, and you know, he'll probably be a fair price in there. But he's only run its synthetic at Woodbine. He's just wondering how we would evaluate a horse moving from synthetic to other surfaces.
JK, you're the Cassie Barn expert on the call here. Why don't you start, and I'll see if I can put some thoughts together about the general question.
Yeah, I mean, it's really easy, especially in a place where you can access the DRF Clocker report. You evaluate a synthetic form by looking at how the horse is working at Palm Meadows on the dirt, and the horse has got the last four works there. I would say it's 98.7% likely that the team at DRF has at least two workouts for the horse, and that's your answer. So I wish I could be a little bit more, give you more info, but there's that answer. And then the other one is he's not going to beat three rules or favorable outcome.
Well, right. You got to factor in a few different things here. One general thing, I think, is not exactly giving away any state secrets here, but looking at the breeding and siblings is going to give you some clues also about a horse's ability to transfer surfaces. But then the other thing I was going to mention that maybe ties in into what Jonathan was saying is looking at the individual, pace scenario and running styles in the race, and just taking the quickest of looks at the Swale, which I have not properly handicapped, it would just seem like, looking at pace numbers, etc., that it might be a little far back to have much of an impact beyond the third and fourth slots in the Super. Just at a very quick glance. But is that something that you find to be true, Jonathan? That horses, they might be going from synth to dirt, but that doesn't necessarily mean their running style is going to be affected?
No, not necessarily. The only tricky thing about synthetic is that a lot of horsemen and jocks don't want to be on the lead. So if they have the speed to go to the front, they won't always use that. And then when they get to the dirt, it might be something that they'll actually do. So that's the only real tricky part about when it comes to running style. I usually just look at it more about the jock, like who's on and then the connections. It's Rosario. He's not typically one that's going to go to the front. I don't see a situation in which this horse gets to the front, especially with three rules in there and some of the other ones. So you know, for me, I don't let the style necessarily – I don't assume the style is going to translate when the surface switches.
Do you have a specific pick in that race? Have you looked at it long enough? I mean, you gave your two horses in there. Do you like one better than the other?
I mean, I think three rules is a sprint freak. I mean, I think that if I could get 25-1 on three rules to win the King's Bishop this year, I would take it right now. I mean, I just think that he's that type of horse. And I think he was a horse that showed some ability going longer, and why they felt like they should take him out to California for the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. I think they learned a lesson with him. But I think he's special in terms of speed when it comes to sprinting, and I think he'll be really tough this year if they will continue to keep him at that at those distances.
The sprint trips not get that temptation to get the Derby fever and go on from there.
And yeah, but don't, I mean, if he wins by seven, they're not gonna. I think they'll probably try again, as I would too.
Yeah, right. No, you're not offering judgment, but you're just saying as a handicapper, you feel like he'll ultimately be better at those shorter trips.
100%.
Mike, did you have any thoughts on the Swale, or should we move on to some of the other three-year-old racing this weekend?
I have a couple thoughts, particularly on Vanish. It's something to follow up on what you said, Pete. Looking at the siblings, he's had one other sibling to run on dirt, Evangeline's Hope. She was 0-for-8 on the dirt. She was 2-for-25 on the synth. She earned by far her best speed figures there. And then the other thing I'll note, this is something that you guys probably don't even realize, but DRF, the trainer stats at the bottom, they do not differentiate dirt and synthetic. So you will not see, for this horse, synthetic to dirt for Mark Cassie on the bottom. Or even more so, if it's turf to dirt for Mark Cassie, that turf to dirt stat at the bottom of the PPs includes all turf to main track efforts.
That seems like a problem, Mike, doesn't it?
Yes and no. I've discussed it with a number of people internally. For whatever reason, that's the way they go with it in the classic PPs. But, of course, in Formulator, when you click on the trainer, you can do a specific dirt to synth, synth to dirt, turf to synth, turf to dirt. You can do all of that sort of things.
Okay.
Here's an example. Cassie, last 5 years, synth to dirt at Gulfstream, 0 for 9. Four did run fourth, so it's not like they were all beaten horribly. But it's a very, very interesting thing, and it's something to look at, especially these Woodbine trainers sending their horses to run on dirt at Gulfstream. There was a Roger Atfield horse who was the favorite, 8-5. Atfield was horrible going turf to dirt at Gulfstream. He'd done it a bunch. He'd never had any success. But the trainer stat below said 23% because it included all the turf to synthetic ones up at Woodbine.
Here's what needs to be done. Now, nobody asked me, but as a guy who's been editing books for, you know, a quarter of a century, more or less, the little text in the bottom of the form, just don't have it say, if it's not recording to dirt, have it say turf to main or something like that.
Right.
Then you're not presenting misinformation in the paper, and folks who want to do the deeper digging still have the chance to get the edge through Formulator.
Exactly. And that's what's going to happen. It's just a matter of item number 400 on a list for them.
How that goes in my personal life and in the inner workings of daily racing form. But that's good. It's good to know you're on it, and that's great. That's great info, actually, and a good opportunity. Another way folks can use Formulator to dig for info. In case folks missed it, gosh, I almost wish we'd uploaded this as a podcast, because I think it was pretty cool. There was some really good stuff yesterday in our sort of NHC deconstruction, using Formulator to show how some of the contest players came up with big winners at NHC 18. We had Roger Satin on the call. We had Elliot Honecker on the call. And you can catch the archive of that at drf.com/YouTube. I guess you can't get it as an MP3 file, but I think it's worth checking out. It was a lot of fun talking to those guys and going through some of the examples from the NHC. All right, let's move on to some of the other three-year-old races of the weekend. I did a little write-up about the Withers for DRF that's going to be appearing as part of their... What is that product called exactly, Mike?
It's the Derby Countdown Guide, I think.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was a chance to get super in-depth. It reminded me of my old blog, The Unbearable Lightness of Betting, where I'd go through and do these sort of deep verdicts on every runner in a race. I may have gotten excited and gone a little bit overboard. I'm sort of waiting to get chewed out by the editorial staff, but it was a lot of fun to do, and I did have at least half an opinion in the race. I was curious, did either of you guys look at that one?
I just looked briefly. I mean, assuming all things are equal, El Arib kind of towers over the field, doesn't he?
He sure does. Certainly your most likely winner by a lot, and a horse that would be on all of my tickets. I just had a little bit of an attraction to the Michael Lerner runner on the outside, Square Shooter, at what should be a nice price. We've talked about the Fair Hill Fitness angle before on the show. I like this horse as a candidate to stretch out. He's one I'd use for a little bit on top and definitely underneath as a possible key in behind El Arib in your exactas and tries. Check out that Derby Countdown Guide if you want my full reckoning of the race. JK, did you look at the Withers?
I glanced at it. I was a little concerned that El Arib might not get through airport security. I'm joking. I retweeted that joke, and I think it's so funny.
you liked it so much, you stole it for your own. I can appreciate it.
I did. It's one of those races, I think, where you get sucked into, ooh, this horse could improve. Ooh, this horse kind of had a trip. Ooh, this one's from Pletcher and Kieran, and ooh, and Ellery wins by 10. It's like, yeah. It doesn't interest me as a real betting opportunity, unless you really like something. But it feels like he's the most likely winner.
Yeah, I thought from a vertical point of view, there could just be a little bit of equity in opposing the McLaughlin and Pletcher runners, who I feel like might be overbet in those slots and certainly have valid chances to run in. But it just seemed like from a risk reward point of view, maybe some good money, if not to avoid those horses completely, just to use them as random contenders and try to stick the landing with Ella Reeb and the likes of Square Shooter. So that was my thought there. Before we get to the public handicapper races, Mike, are there a couple other Triple Crown preps going on as well, right?
Yeah, well, just like you wrote up the Withers, I did a little write-up for the Bob Lewis, which, boy, is maybe not the it probably will be odds on to be weakest Triple Crown prep of the year. I'd be hard pressed to find one that's worse than this 5-horse field. Only one of which has won more than a maiden race. But that said, you know, I mean, maybe one will improve. They all got to improve to really become players on the Triple Crown trail. I don't know if either of you took a look at the race. The most interesting one for me, who's probably going to get bet down a bit, is Royal Mo breaking from the rail. Could very well cut the corner and take them a long way. I think he won't be favored because I think the Hollendorfer Mike Smith horse on the outside, Sheer Flattery, coming off of a maiden win where he got a big buyer, is probably going to be your favorite. So, and then the other three horses that I haven't even mentioned, they're all trained by Doug O'Neill. So,
did you look at that one, JK, with your SoCal expertise? Curious if you have, if any of those are on your watch list or anything going forward.
Yeah, you know, I was interested in Royal Mo, Uncle Mo. Yeah, I was really interested in Uncle Mo.
He looked pretty good in this spot.
yeah, for fun. I was interested in Royal Mo. We thought the track was no good inside majority of the meet. On that day, though, it turned out that it wasn't nearly as bad as it had been. So when I first watched the race and he raced all the way on the inside the entire time, I was pretty impressed by that. I still think he's a good horse, and I wouldn't have any problem, you know, playing him. But I also like the Sheer Flattery horse that ran on New Year's Eve. And I do think that the inside was good that day, and he ran well on the outside. So for me, it would probably be Sheer Flattery. I know that Hollendorfer, was talking about the horse on Bic, actually, when he was on last. So could be a big weekend for Hollendorfer.
So if Doug O'Neill wins, you lose. That's what you're saying, basically.
Essentially. Well, I think it's funny is that Doug O'Neill, there's 5 horses in this race. He's got 3 of them, and he's going to be the third, fourth, and fifth choice.
For sure. Well, and it's funny, 2 of the 3 Doug O'Neill horses are Tisnow colts out of Stormcat Mares. So it's like... It's like there's not a whole lot of variety to choose from in this race.
It's a useful cross.
It is. One other thing I'll mention, Sheer Flattery and Royal Mo were both beaten in races by very, very prominent Bob Baffert horses. Beach Bum and Irish Freedom beat Royal Mo in his first 2 starts, and Mastery and American Anthem beat Sheer Flattery in 2 of his starts. So,
I think I'm not 100% sure, but while I'll talk slow enough to double check it, Sheer Flattery missed the break that day, and I'm pretty sure Royal Mo missed the break too in those 2 races that you're talking about. You know, where they were coming out of the races. Yeah. They did. Both of them missed the break in both of those races.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Even though it's 5-horse field and there's no Bob Baffert horse, it's like the presence of Bob Baffert looms over this field anyway. And actually, no, I take that back. The 5th race, so they ran 5 maiden races before either of them won. The first race, the debut for Sheer Flattery, was also won by a Bob Baffert horse. So.
He's not a large man, but he casts a large shadow. Was there any other Triple Crown stuff this weekend before we dive into PH?
Well, Holy Bull, Classic Empire. We talked about him a little bit.
I told you I have Vegas brain. Return to the races of Classic Empire. We got to talk about him. There have been these stories, you know, as recently as a month ago about maybe him not wanting to train every day. This is a really interesting case of a horse who has so much talent, but seems like he just might be his own worst enemy. What do you do with Classic Empire, JK?
It seems like he's kind of a crazy guy, huh? I mean, the workout report will tell a lot. You know, you want to see what pops up there. But when I look down and I look at figures, it's just not even really close.
Right.
I guess maybe fact finding is one of the most interesting ones. But I always down great horses that get loose at Gulfstream. So, look, if you want to try to get interesting here, go ahead. Obviously, this isn't their goal. If you look at how the Cassies train other good horses, for instance, Teppan, they don't typically crank them for races that aren't the goal. And I would think that the goal with Classic Empire is a little race in Louisville, Kentucky on the first Saturday in May. So I wouldn't expect the best from him here. However, he might just be better than these.
Classic Empire has, right. He's getting some, you know, Dennis Rodman type reputation, that's for sure. Mike Hogan, you have any thought on this race?
Well, I mean, I think he's the best horse in the race. I mean, if you're making a case to beat him, you're making a case that he doesn't run back to one of his previous efforts, because any of those will beat any of these horses in the field, even if they improve. But I think Jonathan's right. If you're going to try and beat him, now is the time to do so. And it's not crazy to think that the connections would be unhappy with a good effort back off the bench where he runs a strong second or third and sets things up for the rest of the year.
I do think that we probably should give at least 30 seconds or 45 seconds to the race on Sunday with Unique Bella and Champagne Room.
Sure.
All I'm going to say is that I just remember the workout report, and I remember Mike's talking about it afterwards, where she is kind of headstrong, and if that comes into play, it could be an issue. She's probably a freak, and she's going to win by 10, but
you're just talking about Unique Bella, just to clarify.
Unique Bella, excuse me. Yeah, just keep that in mind when you're watching the race. She's going to have to learn to relax a little bit as the distances start to increase.
Where would your money be in that race, or have you not fully looked at it yet?
Oh, it's definitely, and this is no offense, but it's not going to be on Champagne Room. So it's either Unique Bella, or I'm going to have to find some 25-1 shot that has no chance.
Interesting. Did you look at that one yet, Mike?
I'm looking at it now. It's a 5-horse field. You know, it doesn't take long to look at it, but I'm kind of with Jonathan. I mean, it's like the Classic Empire race, you know, all things being equal, Unique Bella should crush this field. And she's probably going to be 1-9. She's probably going to be bridge jumped. If I was going to take a shot with anybody, it would probably be the Keith DeSormo one on the outside, who's shown some talent and ran behind Champagne Room, but maybe could move forward and will be a much better price.
We are time and space traveling like in a Heinlein novel here. We're going to go back to Saturday and back across the country to Gulfstream to talk quickly. We're going to have to talk about all these races quickly with only 15 minutes left in the show about the Forward Gal, which goes as race 6. Your morning line favorite is number 4, Pretty City Dancer. Mike Hogan, is this where you're going for the Cassie operation, or do you have something else here?
No, not really. I mean, again, back to Jonathan's point, you know, this is one coming off a layoff, even longer layoff than Classic Empire last race, where in Saratoga, where she dead heated. And you know, look, seems to be a very nice little tap at Philly, and they're probably setting things up for a 3-year-old campaign. But I think she's potentially vulnerable. And, you know, I don't have a strong lean in this race. I think I would just try and lean against beating her. The other Cassie runner actually is probably a little bit interesting. Now might get a little bit more pace to run at than she did last out when she finished behind a couple foes she's going to face tomorrow. And you know, Price is kind of going to be the guide, but that's the one that sort of jumps out at me. Big debut at Keeneland, and then sold privately afterwards, ended up in Cassie's barn, and she could move forward.
You're talking about the 8-horse Summer Luck, just to clarify?
That's right. Yeah, I am talking about Summer Luck.
And Jonathan, I do agree with Mike. It does seem like there is plenty of speed signed on here. You're not exactly known for your love of betting closers. What are you going to do in this spot?
Well, I got a couple of thoughts here. First off, how good is Pretty City Dancer? In August, she worked 3 times with Classic Empire and held her own every time. So whatever that means to you, it means a lot to me for a filly to be worth. I mean, obviously, we know that the fillies kind of can progress faster. But just to say how good she is. For me, I want Wildcat Kate, who grinded down the Bodie's Dream, the Pletcher drawn down inside. Pletcher's going to get crushed in here. Pretty City Dancer's going to get crushed. You're going to get all of 6-1 on Wildcat Kate. She might not be the most likely winner, but I think at the 7, 8, 9, 10-1 you're going to get on her. There's a lot of meat on that bone, and I would try to key her in situations underneath and on top. And if she wins in multi-race situations, you're definitely going to get paid.
How much does it matter to you that she appears to be the outside of the speed horses? Does that sweeten the interest for you, or is it not particularly relevant?
No, and if it was going to be like a dead duel situation, I would hate for her to be on the outside. But it feels like she could possibly be rateable a little bit. She doesn't always have to go to the front. She sat off of off the Todd horse last time. I think she's pretty good. I think that she'll be forgotten. And that's always a positive thing when you can get a horse that's just forgotten because they're just betting other people. And like every point Mike said is real. Pretty City Dancer might not be ready yet. She's got a lot of question marks. Wildcat Kate beat Bodie's Dream last time, and Bodie's Dream's going to still get bet off of that. So there's a lot of different angles here that could see Wildcat Kate kind of cruise up for Kathleen O'Connell, who's not always, crushed at the windows.
No, the crowd does not always come for her, that is for sure. Let's move on to Fairgrounds, and I just have to do a quick aside about Race 5, the Keith G. Memorial. Keith G., great figure in Louisiana racing, and one of the first people I spoke to at my very first NHC, and I think he sort of recognized me as this nervous new guy who didn't know many people and kind of took me under his wing and was just very supportive and helping me with information, finding out who was who. Great guy to speak with and just beloved figure around the racetrack, very involved in helping get that new turf course a few years ago put in down at Fairgrounds, and it just makes me very, very happy to see his memory honored with this race. Jonathan, we'll keep it with you to talk about the situation here. Mike, you had something?
I'm just going to guess. Did Jonathan pick Divisadero's brother?
Well, Jonathan's embarrassed that he didn't know Divisadero's brother was in here.
Missed opportunity.
Okay. Yeah.
No, for me, it's Cool Arrow. When horses can excel on the dirt and win races on the dirt, and then the connections still find it appropriate to avoid Derby fever and run on the grass, like, sign me up. Like, that, I find that to be an extremely telling sign. He's got two turf winners in the female family, and I didn't get to – I was actually in the middle of looking it up right now. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that those two horses' best figures came on the grass. While Mike's talking, I'll confirm that or not. But, that I love when that happens, and so for me, Cool Arrow. The other one inside, the other Sharp, is interesting with that big figure that he got, but for me, it's Cool Arrow.
Mike Hogan, real fast, your thoughts on this race?
Well, this is an interesting race because I think the morning line favorite, Cool Arrow, has never run on the turf before. The other one, Gervin, for Joe Sharp, has never run on the turf before. So I think Cowboy Culture was actually going to be the favorite, 4-1 on the morning line. Brad Cox gets bet heavily down there, especially when Florent Giroux is aboard. He could win, but I'm going to take a shot against him with a horse that I think might present some value, be a little overlooked, and I think has some talent. That's number 6, Art Imitates Life. Went 4 wide both turns, made a middle move on the back stretch and flattened out in the stretch, but then re-rallied a little bit and almost got third in his last start. They add the blinkers. He's worked well since then. He'll be a square price, might be a little overlooked because he finished behind 3 of his competitors in this race. And I just like him. He's got some upside.
Who's the Divisadero half?
Hollyfield, number 8.
And J.K., Neil were Pessin. You able to confirm that fact about the siblings?
I was. Cleverness and Charade, both their top figures were on the grass. So if Cool Arrow improves just a little bit for fun.
Gotcha. All right, let's That's go fair. Back to Gulfstream Park. This time we'll be talking about Race 11. Mike Hogan, we'll go back to you for your thoughts here.
This is the sweetest chant. This is an interesting little race and a lot of different ways to go here. Another one where I think the morning line might be a little shaky. And Chad Brown, I actually looked, I tweeted about it. I don't know if you saw Chad Brown, Javier Castellano, last 5 years, 2-turn turf races at Gulfstream Park. 158 times they've teamed up in those races. the 6-1 morning line on Okinawa. Do you want to guess how many times they had a horse 6-1 or higher?
Probably not too many.
Nine out of 158. And actually, here's another stat. Two wins in 31 starts at 4-1 or higher with those runners. If they don't get bet, they don't win. And I think Okinawa is going to take some money. I'm against him. It's very, very interesting. I don't know if you guys have looked at the Time Form pace projector in this race. Time Form has number five, a great time on the lead in this race. I have to say, I saw that and my heart sank because I love a great time, and I'm afraid that everybody's going to be betting this horse because he's faster than he showed last out. He was the only horse moving late in the stretch in his last race against some horses that would be big shots in this race. He went 54 feet further than the winner Bellevaise, who's quite a good 3-year-old filly for Jimmy Toner. I think she's improving. Her speed figures, even despite that trip, fit very well with this field. And 20-1 morning line might be a little optimistic, but I think she'll still be a little overlooked here. Right, nice. Oh, and long, I should also say,
long shot pick for Mike. We gotta move on here. Long shot pick for Mike in the Swedish Chant. Jonathan, what did you come up with?
I love Compelled. I loved her on debut. Been lucky enough to become friendly with Craig Vernick at Glen Hill Farm, and they love her, and he thinks that that's the best horse that they have on the farm. So she's had some impressive races, and I'll look for her to win here. If it's not her, I want it to be Tamit, because the world is always a better place when Bat Masterson has a good horse.
Is Compelled one of the Vernick horses that was an international good thing at Saratoga? Is this the same one?
This is the gas horse that made my Saratoga flight home from the airport a little bit sadder than it needed to be. But you know, she in that sprint race, she kind of broke slow from the outside. But they love her, and you know, I haven't talked to him specifically, but he said that she's doing great, and that she's the best horse that he thinks that they have.
Interesting.
She tested for class, though. Boy, she beat a nothing field last out. She looked great doing it, but boy, she
Mike, I think we caught up a minute there. JK was brief enough. Did you have one more thought you wanted to get to on this race?
On my other, but my horse, I was just going to say three-fourth sibling to Victor's Cry, who's a really, really good turf horse. And I think this horse will just improve with distance. So anyway, that's all right.
The last race we're going to talk about, we're going back to Santa Anita. Race 9, I think this is the San Marcos, and pretty interesting card at Santa Anita, right? There's something like 4 stakes total for players who are so inclined to come out of their winter hibernation. That Santa Anita card on Saturday might not be a bad place to do so. Jonathan, we'll start with you. Give us an overview of the race. You have a strong opinion. How are you thinking of playing this in general, and what are your specific thoughts?
Well, I panicked a little bit, to be honest, because the turf course is could be a little bit tricky with all the rain they've got. It could be a little bit fuller, a little bit more lush than it normally is. And then I tried to think, well, what do I feel about that? And I couldn't figure out what it meant to me. So I here's where I landed. And we talked about this last year. I actually remember it. It was at Gulfstream. I don't remember the horse. When I'm finding horses that are going to go to a kind of stretch to a distance they've never been to before, I'm looking, I'm paying attention. Are they going to excel at that distance? And for me, it's Perfectly Majestic. You know, going to run it 1.25 miles for the first time. I learned the lesson. I'm not trying to bad beat story you guys, but I learned the lesson in the last mandatory at the NHC that when Kent DeSormo is on a turf horse, you have to give him an extra look. And not doing that cost me making the final 66. So it's not going to happen to me again. I love Kent on the grass, especially at Santa Anita. He just really seems to understand when's the right time to tip out and make his moves and his runs. And for me, it's Perfectly Majestic.
I would agree with that general idea, Jonathan, that the rider jockeys, to me, are important in all races, but they take on particular importance when it comes to the grass. The extra set of skills a jockey needs to have in grass racing, it's different. And for me, more of a handicapping factor. So that doesn't sound crazy to me at all. Mike, where'd you land in the San Marcos?
Well, first I want to ask if Jonathan, did you look at Bob Hess Jr. Dirt to turf last 5 years? Or does it matter?
It doesn't matter because it was off. It was like he wanted to run on the turf, you know, so it doesn't even, and not to be me, I could care like zero about it. You know what I mean? Because I feel like there's no intent for him to run on the dirt there.
What is the number, just out of curiosity?
It's 3 for 50 and a lot of losses at short prices. So.
Did you look, though, how many of them were off-turf races? Because I agree with Jonathan. It's a subcategory that's significant.
Well, it also applies to Blue Tone. I was actually looking at it in terms of Blue Tone, who'd never run on the turf before, ran in that same race and wired the field, is now coming back on the turf.
It does apply to Blue Tone because his five races prior to that were on the dirt. So it does make sense there. But on Perfectly Majestic, it doesn't. To me, it doesn't apply.
That's fair. Yeah, Perfectly Majestic has done it a few times himself in off the turf races and then come back and lost as well. But you know, it's fair. It's not the death knell that I would say it is for Blue Tone. For me, the other question here is Isotherm really going to be 6-1? And if so, I hope so, because this horse always gets bet, never wins.
Yeah, he's definitely had some course excuses. I think we think he likes to run on firm ground, and he's caught some off turf where he's underperformed. But bettors could also be done with him at this point, and also the fact that it's out kind of playing a different game in California could come in.
Yeah.
I think 6-1 might be one of those morning lines. It's almost like this isn't a prediction of what the horse is going to be. It's an over-under. That's how that just feels
right,
to me.
Right, exactly. He could be 4-1. He could be 12-1.
And it's very hard. For a morning line maker, you kind of have to pick, and I think, you know, understandably, that line came up.
Feels like he'll be bet with Flavion.
Yeah, maybe. And I sure hope so. I mean, he's never run a race fast enough to beat this field, that's for sure. So I hope he gets bet. I'm going to take a shot with a bit of a long shot who is another one stretching out or hasn't had success at the 10 furlongs, or at least it doesn't seem like it's his best distance. And that's number one, A Red Tie Day, coming out of that same race as a lot of the others, Blue Tone and Perfectly Majestic and 2020 Vision, who I also think has a shot in here. But he gets back to the turf. He's going to be on the inside. He's going to be pressing the pace, if not on the lead. He could get a decent trip. Corey has the mount and 15-1 morning line for Baltus, who just won a race yesterday going dirt to turf in a stakes race with Goodyear for the Roses. This is a move Baltus does quite well, and I think A Red Tie Day could be a little overlooked.
All right, good stuff, gentlemen. Thank you for your thoughts on those races. If folks want to get involved in a free contest themselves, check out publichandicapper.com. This is, I think it might be the first weekend or the second weekend at the latest of the PH Prep, the contest before their big one that involves a lot of the Triple Crown Prep races. It's a lot of fun to be able to write your own analysis, to read other players' analysis, and get to compete for fabulous weekly and monthly prizes, all for free at publichandicapper.com. That's all the time we have, guys. I wish you both the best of weekends. We will be back doing a show on Tuesday. Anything else special coming up, Mike? Do we have another webinar in the works?
Oh, we do have one at some point, but I haven't even checked the schedule. It's either scheduled for next week or the week following. Another time form one. So I got to nail that one down, make sure we're still on board for it. And we'll talk about it next Tuesday.
That reminds me, I wanted to highlight before when we were talking, maybe we'll talk about it the next show. Very interesting conversation about figures between two of the sharpest guys I know around the racetrack, Craig Mulkowski and Duke Matisse, happening on Twitter. If folks don't follow those guys, you probably should. Lots of interesting stuff there. But again, we are wrapping. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. Thank you for joining us, especially the folks who joined live through Spreaker. You can also find that live feed through Twitter and the Tuesday show. You can find that live feed through the DRF Facebook Live. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Mike Hogan. I want to thank all of you for listening. We will see you real soon. May you win all your photos.